Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Stephen the Warman Writes Kickfighting Podcast Show. I'm your host, Stephen Warman. You are listening to this podcast in one of various ways, thanks to the people at Between Rounds Radio and the homeboy TJ DeSantis from Minnesota out there in California doing good things in the podcasting world. Excited to get back to you guys. I would have been here last week, but I was trying to get the podcast back to the earlier part of the week. We had a lot of shows coming out. We had a lot of in early March. There were a lot of there's a lot of kickboxing late February. So I was trying to do the show later in the week so that we were a little bit closer to the kickboxing action. But last week when I was getting ready to do the show, I was like, man, I want to go ahead and change that, get it towards the beginning of the week, in particular because we have so many people who are in a isolated situation, you know. So this is an opportunity for you guys to go down memory lane with me and do kickboxing. I'm going to hit up a lot of stuff. I might break down an old fight card all the way. But as for today, I'm going to go back into my team of the decade for the 2010s, and I'm going to do the heavyweight division. So before I get into it, lrdgaul.podbean.com is my blog. Also, enter Warman Kickfighting Show into the iTunes search engine, and the show pops right up. So those are the ways that are probably the most efficient because I usually post the pod being everywhere and I usually get it up on iTunes right away. So I'm glad that you guys are here with me and I hope I can provide you guys some entertainment in this down period of time in our world. So we'll go ahead and get right into it. First of all, heavyweight was probably the hardest division that I had to do. The reason why is because there's one clear-cut number one guy, and then I had to figure out how I was going to do the rest of the list. At one period of time, I had three people. One period of time, I had two people. I was like, you know, I need to have a solid four. I've got some more in the other weight classes, you know, but really I'm just saying, hey, this is an argument for what you did in the weight class over that 10-year period. And some people, you can, you know, make the argument that they could have been in this list as well. But if you look at consistency, and in particular, if you look at a period of time when you were particularly violent, you know, as far as heavyweight division stoppages go a long way, that really comes into play when I was breaking this list down. So we'll go ahead and jump right into it. First guy I have on the list for the 2010s team is a guy who actually started off a little bit on the rougher side when he got things going. But the number one guy I have on this list, but the first guy I'm going to mention on this list is Daniel Gita. So my thing with Daniel Gita is when the 2010s started, it was not the hottest for him. You know what I'm saying? He had the Drazen Petrovic win, but Drazen Petrovic win, and Karatanov was before it. So then he had the Ashwin Balrock loss, and that was on its Showtime. He had an Errol Zimmerman win, and that was the big left, you know, want to say that the combination flurry that he put together to get the stoppage and the Seoul, Korea Final 16 round. Then he loses to Gokhan Saki in one of the great fights of the 2010s. And then he has the loss to Hezdy Hegas, where I was there for that event, that Showtime event. And so I was in the back. I got to get all the footage of them warming up and training and so on. And he just, at one period of time, he actually, like, taunts Hezdy, and he doesn't get into his game like he usually does. And I remember, you know, him and his coach, Anil, talking. He goes, hey, the reason why you lost is, and they're kind of breaking down, you know, because they were the main event. So that was kind of how he got this thing started. After that, then he fights in Lyon, France, which I was there for too, which makes me feel really, really old. But, like, that's where this thing starts rolling. Like, that's where he starts to develop one of the more dominant streaks as a kickboxer. He's going to go get victories against Fikri Amezian, Erhan Deniz. He gets the rematch over Hezdy Hegas with one of the big-time left-hook KOs you're ever going to see. The Sergey Lysenko victory, Brian Dowell's victory. And at this period of time, he's really showing off the skill with the left hook, just really dropping everybody with it. Wendell Rocher fights him on short notice. It was supposed to be someone else for that event, but he got the Wendell Rocher fight. There's another Zavid Podorok victory, the Jonathan Deniz victory, the Murad Bozidi victory, and the Jamal Ben Sadiq victory. These are the fights that I just mentioned, and this stretch from 2011, from May of 2011, all the way to what would be the December 31st of in Glory Tokyo in 2012. Of this streak of fights that I just mentioned to you, these victories, only one of them was a decision. All of them were KOs. Like a couple of TKOs for people who are blown them, you know, who that matters to. But he got stoppages in all those fights. At this period of time, everybody was thinking, this is the guy. This is the best guy in the world. It's just, he just needs to prove it. The only problem with it is he still had a couple of people who were, you know, had some hangover careers. Like there was a little bit left in their career. So he, after this, you know, run that I'm talking about, he goes against Semi Schilt in the final of the Glory tournament. And that was their big one. That's when they did the 16 man in one night. So he had some things that were, and then of course, after that one, he also had a Gokhan Saki loss, and that was the big, huge combination loss. So there were some ups and downs over this period of time, not to mention the retirement that kind of he went into and then came out of. But after the Gokhan Saki loss, he had Bryce Gidon victory. He had the Anderson Broderick Silva victory. He had a Rico loss in the final, and that was when the night that we can all make the argument that Rico became king was the 2013 Chicago card where Rico won that tournament. That was in October of that year. Again, making me feel old. I was there for that. Just a really good run. And then we have the Errol Zimmerman victory, another KO stoppage. He has the Rico Verheeren loss and the rematch in Los Angeles. And then he's gone from the sport for 4 years doing things like charitable things. And I saw that he was doing his best to raise money for hospitals. And like he became a different individual. And then he came back later in his life. He's not that old, but, you know, old enough for that break to be significant. But he took some time away to focus on some things, did some acting. But really, we're talking about one of the great talents. He's older now, 38 years old, but he had a great run, you know, where, with him and his coach, Anil Dabar. But the resume that they had for the 2010s is really made up off of what he did in the first half of it. That stretch where he went 2011 to the end of 2012, that's really, I'm telling you, if you're on the fight forums, if you were, you know, because that's when the fight forums were just kind of slowly going away, but there's still some talk, still some, you know, Kakutugi was still out there, and, you know, they were just kind of at the end, and we're starting to slowly move into Twitter, but everyone still felt, this is the guy to pay attention to, you know what I'm saying? If you went to liverkick.com, you look at the write-ups and the reports, everyone felt this was still the guy. So he had a great run, and he had a great overall career, but in the 2010s, I would say that stretch of fights and those KO victories, very, very important for his overall legacy and what has him on my list for the team 2010 to 2019. Even though the second half of his 2019 or 2010s wasn't as hot, that first half was so, so good, in particular that streak that he had. So now we move on to the next guy on the list, another guy who really doesn't give us anything in the kickboxing world for the last 5 years, but he was just so hot. He had some solid victories very early on, and that's why he's on this list. So we are going to go to Gokhan Saki. Gokhan Saki gets this one started off in January 24th, where he gets Dennis Stolzenbach. That victory by unanimous decision, again, we still don't know what he's going to be. He had fought in K-1 a few times by this time, you know, and he'd actually ended the 200s or 2000s on a bad roll. You know, he lost to Kitaro. Again, he had taken damage in after the fight with Tyrone Spong, lost to Pavel Zarovlev, again, injured in that one, lost to Peter Arts. Just, he came in on a streak of things not going his way when the 2010s ended. And again, it's just, it started off, you know, an era that had him win a K-1 tournament in Hawaii, had the Ray Seffel victory, had the Ruslan Karev victory, had the Bondrowski loss with no shame there. And then, of course, I mentioned the Tyrone Spong fight. So things were going his way for the, you know, for a little bit. And then at the end of 2009, things started to change. So when he got to the 2010s, he had to change things back. The fights that came into play, the Utley Mariana, I very underrated, and I thought Utley was a solid fighter, but a solid KO victory there. The Singh Jadeep fight, very important to get that win. Probably should stop Singh Jadeep, but Singh still had some good skill and he was long, had a little bit of a name. Definitely shout out to him for getting that victory. Melvin Manhoff got that victory. That was a stoppage. They really, really pumped that for the It's Showtime Amsterdam Arena. The Freddie Camacho fight, people still talk about. It's still one of the highlights that you will see in kickboxing because it's such a smooth kickboxing victory and his excitement afterwards coming to play. The Daniel Guida victories. The first one, of course, was in that war that I talked about. Just an awesome, awesome fight at the first round of the quarterfinals of the 2010 K1 World Grand Prix. Then we had the Alistair Overeem fight where he's pretty much winning the fight with one arm. So as soon as Overeem like throws a kick at the injured arm, which was injured from the Guida fight, he goes down. But he kind of just showed you just in that small period of time, this guy's legit. So he gets Brendan Rocha after that, gets Bryce Guinan after that, has a Badr Hari loss, and that was one of the better ones for Badr, I think, in his career. It was right before Badr was going to stop and go into boxing. But of course, it didn't materialize, but at the time, it was a big deal. So then he gets the Carter Williams victory, and that's at the first Glory event, 2012, and that was in May. Gets the Carter Williams victory. Gets the Murad Buzidi victory, gets the Muramaro victory, and that was in the big 16-man tournament I was telling you guys about. He also beats Anderson Braddock Silva there, loses to Shimmy Schilt, gets a Daniel Guida victory, gets a Nathan Corbett, gets Tyrone Spong, and then Sebastian Chiavono is the last fight that he had before moving into MMA. So I look back on that, and I look back on that history, and I look back on what he accomplished. For the most part, you could say, man, there might be guys with more wins, you know what I'm saying? You got some Jamal Ben-Sadiq, stuff like that. But I look at the losses, and the losses are Verhoeven, Schilt, Hari, Overeem. And Overeem, who was injured for. So Overeem, who won the K1 World Grand Prix that year, those are really high-level losses. And you've got the Guida victories. You've got a couple of them. I mentioned Spong and Corbett. That's at, you know, light heavyweight. So you can make the argument there that maybe you shouldn't be on the list because that's those don't count. But for me, I'm fine with them because really you're talking about two fights at the end of his Glory run. So great job there. Sold out the arenas. I really, really prioritize. Anderson Braddock Silva was a good win for anybody. But I really like the Daniel Guida victories and the timing in which they came. So it's tough to pick the third, fourth people. But I really had to make an argument for why I think it should be Gokhan Zaki over some of the other guys. I just like his wins, and I like his losses. So that's kind of why I put him on the list. Next person we're going to talk about is Benjamin Adegbuyi. To me, this was my clear number two for this class. He has 34 wins in the 2010s. Okay, that is by far the most of any heavyweight in the world. Okay, his losses, Jamal Ben-Sadiq, Guto Inosante, debatable there. Split decision, debatable on that one. So you got some people who, you know, have their arguments there. The Rico Verhoeven losses, and then he's got a Pavel Zarevov loss. That's pretty much it. Oh, wait, he's got a Druzinho Rusin streak. I forgot about that one. He's got that loss too. But for the most part, those are really, really good fights. Really good high-level guys. Rusin streak doing his thing in mixed martial arts right now. Pavel Zarevov. Had a great run, still fights in kickboxing in his home country. That was, to me, and of course, Rico, he has good wins, but the good losses matter so much to me. So we'll go ahead and roll through these wins. The Mladen Brastovic won. Mladen, very tough guy, and of course, you guys saw he had a couple opportunities to, you know, get that head kick going against Rico Verhoeven. Didn't happen, but he's able to get victories outside of it. So, shout out to Mladen Brastovic there, in his efforts. But Adegbuyi goes forward. He gets the Jafar Amadi victory. Sergey Lysenko, you know, who's not with us anymore. Just a great fighter who was down to compete all the time, you know. So, definitely include that Sergey victory. And while we're at it, it should be noted that there are other Romanian stars in the world, you know, in kickboxing. Like, there really are, like, other high-level kickboxers from Holland, you know, or from Romania. But to me, far and away, I look at those guys and I say, hey, you guys are good. You guys had good runs. There are people that are more popular than him. But the unchallenged best kickboxer for me to come from Romania is Adegui. He's really, really good. I like him over both the Stoicas, who are very good fighters. But I really, really like his resume. Anyways, we'll continue to roll. He gets a rematch and beats Ruzhin Strick in the second one. Gets an Ishmael Lant victory. Gets a Pavel Zurevlov victory. Another one avenged. So I'm talking about like getting back in there with someone that you lost to and then getting a W. That I rank that very highly. The Daniel Sam victory in glory. The Hezzy Hargis victory in glory. Then we talk about the Rico loss. Then he goes back. Another victory over Vladan Brustovic. A victory over Jafar Wilnes. Then another Rico loss. And then he has a great stretch where he goes Bolotov, Colin George. I'm okay on the Steve Rajit victory. That's just okay. But he was got the quick KO there. Hezdy Hargis, another Brustovic win. And Anderson Broderick Silva. Debatable loss to Guto Innocente. Depends on who you talk to. And then he's got a D'Angelo Marshall victory, a Junior Tapa victory, a Jafar Wilnes victory again, another Jafar Wilnes victory, not to mention Arkadiusz Wierzyk victory inside of there, and then his last fight in glory was a victory over D'Angelo Marshall. That's just, to me, the second best resume in the 2010s, unchallenged. Adegui is that deal. He's a great fighter. He's a great fighting personality. He's fun to be around. When I work the glory events and he's there, I always want to hear what he's saying. And again, he's doing this in a second language. But he is just a top talent. He's so exciting to watch. He's so skilled. He represents the high level of new heavyweight kickboxing. The guys in the 90s, talented. Not all of them the most technically skilled. There's some people that I look and I go, okay, you got in here just because you're a big banger. But he represents the Rico Verhier, Van Gogh, Kanzaki type of heavyweight where they come with so much technical skill. So shout out to him and the things that he brings to the table. And he really is the unchallenged, for me, second best kickboxing heavyweight there is. Just in the 2010s. Really, really great job. So now I'm going to go to a very super obvious number one, and the king, Rico Verhierven. So I've said this story before, and I will say it again, because I'm looking at it right in front of my face. I had known who Rico Verhierven was. I had seen him on the undercard of a Showtime event. I want to say real early on, like 2007, I want to say it was. I'm pretty sure it was that. I could be wrong. But, like, he was on the undercard in terms of, like, he had a B-class fight or something like that right when the card got going. So there was a lot of fights on the card. There's, like, barely any crowd there. Me and my friend Tom were there early because we were trying to watch the whole event. You know, I'm watching everything. And Tom would always joke with me. He goes, these guys are kickboxing stars to you, but because I've watched them my whole life, it's not that big of a deal. So I remember that. So this is my first time getting a look at Rico. Huge guy, you know, had the muscular frame, very young, wasn't even 18 the first time I seen him. So then I'm watching him compete, and then I get there again. So he's starting to, you know, move up the Showtime card, starting to get some solid wins. The Philip Verlinden win was good. The Peter Mastrovic victory was solid. He's starting to get those opportunities. Not to mention, you know, here and there, he gets like some K1 underfights cards. The Kiyoshi Watanabe fight, sample, I think that was in Hawaii. That sort of thing happens. You know, opportunity came up. Bryce Guidon, I remember that came up. Ishmael Lant loss. He had some good stuff going for him, but he wasn't all the most consistent guy. So we go to Javed Prodorok. It's the first victory he gets in the 2010s. He gets Ricardo Vandenbos. That's a good win for him there. And then we go Michael Duke and Frank Munoz. So these are all victories that he's getting at the heavyweight division. Then comes my real, real introduction to him. I do a long interview with Simon Roots. And in the video, Simon Roots talks about Rico. And he says, this kid, Rico Verhierven, I truly believe he's going to be the future of kickboxing. I truly believe he's going to be the best heavyweight in the world one day. He's 18 years old at this time. I want to say 18, 19. He could be 20. I think he's 20 at this time, actually. So, like, he says that. And Dan Rico goes out there and he gets stopped by Jabal Ben Sadiq. Just Ben letting those big hammers go, scores something big, he goes down. So I go, all right, well, maybe we're too early to make that prediction. But he goes out there and gets stopped after we kind of get this hype. Then he goes out, gets some wins, gets the Justin Smith win. There's a Hezzy Haggis win in there. So he goes out there and gets some wins, gets another Showtime opportunity, loses by left uppercut, if I remember correctly, to Errol Zimmerman. Gets a Ben Edwards victory, then loses to Sergey Lysenko. Gets another Hezzy victory, gets a Sergey Karatanov victory, and then the fight that changed it all. He was struggling with consistency, as I mentioned to you guys before. We got some wins, we got a loss. We got a win, we got a loss. We got a couple wins, we got a loss. So he's struggling with consistency, and this is at the beginning of the decade. So then he fights Semi Silk, and he said after that fight, he was like, if Semi can't hurt me, you know, because I think Karatanov was his first round opponent, second round opponent was Semi Silk. He was like, if you can do good there, I think you can change this around. Him and his coach were talking about it. If you guys heard my Shin on Shin documentary, talks about it really well because Rico can really talk. He's a really good interview. And Rico says, he's talking to his coach afterwards. He goes, you know where you're going to fix. We're going to keep working. And then he started training with Tyson Fury and he started boxing with him. His pad holder would work with him and then vice versa. So he's like learning all the time. And he says, coach is like, I'm going to prepare you so that when you get to the top, you're going to get there and you're going to stay there. And I remember him saying this in the interview. The interview that he says this to me in is after he wins the Glory Chicago tournament where he beats Gokhan Saki and he beats Daniel Guida. So he has gone through this period of inconsistency and then he goes first on a tour of getting some victories back. So he gets the Jonathan Denise fight, gets the Errol Zimmerman victory, got that victory back. Gokhan Saki, Daniel Guida, that's the night in Chicago that I talked to him. After that, he gets the Peter Arts victory. Very important because part of what makes Rico special is the fact that he is the bridge. He's the gap between old K1 and new glory. Like he was coming in at the end of K1 and then he started to have success at the beginning of Glory. But it was important for all the new guys to get victories over the old guys on their way out. So those kind of wins are big. So got the Peter Arts victory, and it was in Japan, no less. So good stuff there. Gets the Daniel Guida victory, also very important, because as I said before, Guida had just come off that streak where people were wondering if he was the best in the world. And when he got the victory over, Rico got the victory over Guida the first time, then you could see that, all right, maybe we're wrong about this. Maybe because Guida still, you know, seen as the best in the world. He was just robbed. The decision wasn't right, Chicago. Like, that's how people felt. So you go ahead and you go from there and you move over to this situation with Daniel Guida. And then you see, all right, Guida is got a full camp. Everything's behind him, healthy. He should be able to get Rico the second time. So when Rico won that one, that's when people realized, okay, he's legit the best in the world. He has the Grusmanchuk loss. They took on short notice because he needed some money, needed the money, and as the story say. And that was in China. I want to say it was earlier in that year. Yes, very early. It was the third of 2015. So he had that loss, but that loss was a product if he had been knocked down a couple of times. But if you look at the skill, he had really turned it around. He just couldn't get the knockdown back after he was down. So he goes into the rest of the 2010s. So right now on the calendar day, we're looking at a Grusmanchuk fight. He is 2015, January 3rd is his last loss. He then goes on the run that makes him the best heavyweight of this era. Gets a victory by stoppage over Errol Zimmerman. Beats Benjamin Adekwue. Stops Benjamin Adekwue with the right hand in the next one. Beats Mladen Brustovic. Stops Anderson Broderick Silva. Stops Badr Hari, the arm injury. Beats Ismail Azar, very tough guy there. Beats Antonio Broderick Silva. Beats Jamal Ben Sadiq, KO there. Beats Mladen Brustovic. Beats Guto Inocente, beats Badr Hari again. But, of course, you guys know how that one went down, the most recent one. But that streak means that he is going in with the title. He's got the title around his waist, and it is up to the world to get a victory back on him. It doesn't happen. So, and apologize. I said Anderson Broderick Silva. I meant to say Antonio Silva, who had left the MMA and then tried kickboxing. The reason why I've got no problem with that fight being added to the resume, because it kind of takes me back to the era when we had Bob Sapp. And Bob Sapp, of course, was this hulking figure, but he brought in that K-1 element of a super fight. I'm going to take this guy from this discipline and have them fight this MMA guy, have them fight this kickboxer in kickboxing. So when they made this fight with Antonio Silva, I was completely fine with it because it played that role. It played the role of come in, compete against one of our better guys, and just kind of see what it looks like when a kickboxing striker goes against an MMA striker. So I was fine with that. But all in all, the only true asterisk during that period of time is the way the Barahari fight ended. But I think he was in the fight, and, you know, it would have been, you know, interesting to see it play out had Bader not got injured. You know, I mean, Bader could have, you know, won by stoppage, or Rico could have weathered the storm and came back. Rico weathered the storm earlier. So it really was an awesome decade. And like I said, there's nothing more important than the idea and the mentality towards Rico Verhoeven was he went from the prince to the king. Everybody knew this guy's a legit talent. And at the beginning of the decade, your middle of the decade, people would say, you know, he's good, but I don't think he compares to the better guys in the 90s. Now you look at his skill set, most people go, I think if you were to put him in there, he would match right up with any of those guys. Doesn't mean he'd be undefeated, you know what I'm saying? But, like, go ahead, put him in there with Bernardo and Cepho and LeBanner and Arts and Hoost. Put him in there with all those guys in their prime. I think that he does just fine. Just fine. He is the best heavyweight kickboxer in the world. He is extremely talented. He represents a new breed. He can go low kick to the inside leg of both legs. He can go low kick to the outside leg of both legs. His boxing got better. His work rate. He's just a phenomenal, phenomenal kickboxer. He does the interviews. He looks the part. Like, if you were like, hey, who's the best kickboxer in the world? And you point at him, a lot of people are like, whoa, you know what I'm saying? Like, looks like that's probably true. He is legit. You have to give him his due. Rico Verhoeven is the unchallenged best heavyweight from 2010 to 2019. And we'll see what happens as he winds down the rest of his career. He's got some good money put aside. I think he really likes acting, really likes going into that. So I think that that's going to be a big part of his life. I love that he signed a 3-fight deal with Glory to, you know, to keep active, and because I just love watching him as a kickboxer. It's just one of my favorite things. He is a star for us. So really good stuff, and that will conclude my heavyweight. So I understand that people are going to hear my heavyweights for the 2010s, and they're going to wonder about a couple of names. And there are some arguments for some other guys. And I mentioned Jamal Ben-Sadiq, but he had 3 different periods of inconsistency over that period of time. So he's good, but, you know, there's those struggles in there. The Wilness, of course, Shafar Wilness, he had some great runs. He's got a victory over the Gruz Machuk, the same guy who has victory over Bader, so I'm assuming over Rico. So there were some names that I could have put in this, but I really like the ones that I gave you guys. I like those 4. And, of course, I'll hear any dissent or any argument, but those are the 4 that I have for the heavyweight division. I'm going to wrap this show up by giving you guys some time to really look at one of my favorite gyms in the kickboxing world. Go to Remy Bonjasky versus Barahari 1. The first time they met was in the quarterfinals of the K-1 World Grand Prix. And in it, you get the best of both worlds, where you get change of styles, where you get good kick defense, you get good offense. Like, it's just wonderful stuff. So Bader, of course, has always offered more in the power. But Remy is one of the smartest guys that I've ever seen kickboxing. His IQ is really high. He understands how to win scorecards. This fight comes out, and they're both putting on a clinic for combinations and low kicks. Simple. Win it. Jab low kick. Hook low kick. You get low kicked, you counter right back. They're playing very, very safe. Very, very clean. And if you guys watched Bader in the beginning, and I've mentioned this before, when I was out in Holland, I remember someone was talking, and I was one of the bigger guys there, and I was training. He was like, be technical and clean like Barahari. And I remember hearing that. A lot of people think about him when he's, you know, winging those wide shots, and he does do that. But when Botter is at his best, it's what you see in the Glaube-Fitoza fight. Absolutely clean, jab low kick, super fast. Hook low kick, super fast. Cross switch kick, super fast. 1-2-3 high kick or 1-2-3 low kick, cross hook low kick. When he's at his best, his guard is high, he's moving around, and he whips a combo so fast and hard, you just can't keep up with it. So round one, that's what you were seeing. But he's going against the great Remy Bonjasky. So Remy is taking some low kicks here and there, but he's checking some too. And then Botter's taking some low kicks here and there, and he's checking some every once in a while. I would say at the end of the first, after a good spirited back and forth, I would say that Botter probably took the lead a little bit more. And who started the combination. At the end of that round, you would look at the offense of Botter Hari and the power boxing, and I would say he ticked round one. You go into round two. The great ones always adjust. Bonjasky realizes the dead times are the times that he's going to throw strikes at him. Like that, those are the times that Botter's going to get off. So he comes out, throws combo. Botter gets going, and this time, whenever Botter would go with his power boxing, Remy would, you know, put that guard, as Mike Chiavello always says, that virgin guard. He'd put his hands up strong, and then he'd walk him down. So he played the pressure game for at least a minute and a half. Anytime Botter threw something, he'd eat it on the guard, and he'd move forward. He'd send the message, I'm not going backwards, don't care how hard you hit. He kept working his single low kick game, and there, I would say round two, he started to change things around. So we're one apiece going into the third. Round three, you can see the pressure has worked in favor of Remy. Botter is slowing, still active, still dangerous, still putting up numbers, but the punches aren't as powerful. His feet aren't always with him. He's swinging, and Remy knows it. So Remy's no longer backing up. He's still staying close. And there was a period of time where I would say that Botter was still scoring more in the round than Remy was because he just kept throwing. And then the fight turns around with 1 minute left in the third where Remy, who had already been working the low kicks and had been working it, he sees the benefit of the work and he starts to hurt Botter with the low kicks. He had landed a period of time where he landed like 4 or 5 clean. And then all of a sudden, the legs hurt. The punches are affected. He's trying to Botter's trying to hide the leg. He's not returning offense as much. He's wounded, but he's still dangerous. But he's just wounded. And you see the veteranship of Remy take over the round. They go to the scorecards. There's one draw, but then two people have it in favor of Remy Bonjasky. The reason why I think everybody should watch this fight is it is clean kickboxing at its most technical. It is two heavyweight guys who are in the mold of the future heavyweights, as I mentioned before. And really, really do think that we should give Remy a little bit more credit for his role in there. Clearly, Rico is the guy, but Remy should get some love for being a technical kickboxer as a heavyweight. He should be one of the names mentioned for creating our new generation of guy. Because there are still, you know, we still have a Ben Sadiq, you know, he's like a banger, kind of like what you got from your Bernardos and stuff back in the day. But really, it's just clean, smooth kickboxing by both of these guys. And they both represent the future of what kickboxing became. And you could even see it later in his life, you know, Botter in his 30s, now still a clean, technical kickboxer when he puts it together. Just they master the basics. Jab low kick, hook low kick, cross hook low kick, cross switch kick. Like the basics are mastered, but you see it all. You see them check kicks. You see them block high kicks. You see them block body kicks. Like you see the sport at its best in the heavyweight division. So I will go ahead and pop one of these gems to remember here and there. But other than that, man, I'm so grateful to have you guys listen to my podcast. To the best of your abilities, stay home, get better. Now, again, as things change in your government and they ask, you know, you get a little bit more leniency to go out, still be smart, you know, still be wise. But I will tell you this, as a person who's doing this podcast and the person who owns a gym, who's, you know, been hit, of course, because gyms can't be open at this period of time. You are hearing it from me first. I have left my house twice in the last month, you know, like that is it. Whatever I can do to help the world this period of time, I will do. So I'm just suggesting to you guys, do your best. when you got to go to work, I understand because we got bills to pay. But man, do our best to be safe and look out for one another. All right, and let's do this together. You know what I'm saying? Like, this doesn't have to be a what the medical professionals are doing and what other people. It's no. This is us as a whole, as a people, doing this together. We've got, you know, people of every faith, people of every race. All of them are working in medical facilities, doing their best. We've got them working in political offices, doing their best. We've got them working on corner stores, grocery stores, restaurants, doing their best. As a people, let's look out for one another and keep ourselves together and enjoy the best sport in the world, kickboxing. God bless everybody. So grateful to everybody that's listening to the podcast. And I look forward to coming back next week with another one. All right, peace.